Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2020. I'm now here with Carl Thorburn, who has a Telegram channel which is all about Bitcoin, and he is a Bitcoin evangelist and what's called a Bitcoin maximalist. And he's going to explain, again like we did the previous night, but this will be a different treatment of the same topic. He's going to explain what Bitcoin is, what it can do for you, what you can do with it, and why you should get into it. So a general quick start guide for anyone who doesn't know the first thing about it. So welcome to Millennial, Carl.
Hey, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be on. It's really tough to get started because it's like you don't really know where to start. But I guess really, if you wanted to buy Bitcoin, let's just say.
Before we get into that, let's just say, what is it? How does it differ from ordinary money? What is Bitcoin?
Prior to the creation of Bitcoin in 2009, it was not possible to have digital items that you could not replicate. So in other words, like an MP3 or, you know, video files or whatever, it's always possible to copy them infinitely. And the same is true with money, of course. Any digital money you can create as much as you want of. So it was a huge computer science challenge, basically, was to come up with a way to make a digital money that was impossible to forge and impossible to counterfeit, even by a central authority. So even the guy running the network couldn't create more of it, even if he wanted to. So in 2009, an anonymous person using a Japanese pseudonym posted a paper on a really obscure cryptography forum. And he basically outlines in the paper a way to do it, a way to have a token that is truly unforgeable. This also digital. And so this was a big breakthrough, and it really, honestly, it should have been newsworthy, but because of the fact that it was kind of a geeky, weird project, it was kind of, you know, out of the spotlight for a long time. And initially, okay, the only people interested in it were, you know, cryptographers and computer scientists and kind of wacky libertarians. And over time, what happened was basically that you had all these boom-bust cycles, and each boom-bust cycle took it to a slightly higher level. Well, not slightly higher, it was, you know, astronomically higher level, until finally here we are today. You know, I think we just recently went over 20,000 again.
So, I think it's now 23,000. It hit that recently. It hit 23,000. Per Bitcoin. So one Bitcoin is worth 23,000 US
now,
dollars.
I should say, though, that it's extremely divisible. So a single Bitcoin is divisible into 100 million parts. So just the fact that one Bitcoin is worth, you know, 20 whatever thousand, that doesn't really mean anything. That's just the location of the decimal place. So really, if you're looking at Bitcoin and you're thinking this thing is way too expensive,
you can buy any tiny amount of Bitcoin. That's important for people to know.
Right. And I'm kind of an advocate of eliminating the decimal entirely. Like, you know, there's almost no point to having it anymore. In the early days when Bitcoin was still worth like a few cents or whatever, it made a lot of sense to have that decimal place there. But now you might as well just say 20 million Satoshis or whatever, right? The unit itself, the smallest unit of Bitcoin, is named Satoshi in reference to the creator, or just SAT for short, S-A-T. But So the wacky thing about Bitcoin is that it keeps going up despite repeatedly having these periods where everybody's just assuming it's dead or in the process of dying. It always somehow miraculously recovers and makes a new all-time high. And if you study the history of it, you'll see that this has happened multiple times. I mean, throughout, ever since like 2010, there have been over 100 news articles saying that Bitcoin is dead. It's finally over with. And, you know, from the perspective of somebody who's thinking of Bitcoin in terms of like a consumer good, like if you're thinking of it like sneakers or, you know, some jewelry or something like that, there's really, it's kind of mysterious. Like, why do people care so much about this token? You know, what causes it to keep going up? What makes it special? And in fact, it's even more weird when you study it, because then you're like, well, the transaction fees are expensive. It takes a long time to settle a transaction, usually more than 10 minutes. You're talking like, why not just use PayPal? Or, you know, why not use some other means of transferring money? Or, you know, why not just use gold? And so really...
Well, that's a good question. Yeah. What is the answer to that? Why not just use PayPal?
Yeah, well, so this goes to the fundamental, the core value proposition of Bitcoin is that it is the most scarce liquid asset in human history. And the scarcity of Bitcoin, the 21 million coin limit, is what makes it so valuable to global markets. So, you know, getting Bitcoin is not easy. You've got to jump through hoops to get it, you know, and it's inconvenient. It's sort of clunky as a computer network. But the reason everybody wants it and the reason that the price continually climbs is because it has this weird attribute that no other asset before it has ever had, which is that, I'll try to explain it, but what it is, if you could imagine, like, imagine you own like a big plot of land, and you know that buried in that ground somewhere is a bunch of gold. But the problem is that in order to dig up that gold and refine it and sell it, that costs a lot of money. You've got to hire the equipment. You've got to get the guys out there to do it. And you might end up losing money in the process, because if the price of gold falls enough, it won't be profitable to actually go through with it. So in many cases, people know where gold is located, but they don't dig it up because it's too expensive to get it. Now, what happens is eventually the price of gold will rise to a level to where it suddenly becomes profitable and makes sense to dig up the gold. And at that point, what happens is all the miners go out, get the gold, and flood the market with fresh gold. Now, that has that's like a feedback mechanism. It causes the price of gold to go back down to sort of an equilibrium level. With Bitcoin, this same phenomenon can't happen. So the network has pre-programmed from day one. It tells the miners exactly how many coins that they're rewarded each block. And no matter how high or how low the price of Bitcoin goes, the miners are still only rewarded that fixed amount each block. And so what that means is that unlike physical commodities like gold or silver or platinum or whatever, the price doesn't have an influence on the increase of supply or the so-called inflation rate. And this is the reason that Bitcoin is what I would describe as, or I think what most people would describe as, the most scarce liquid commodity, because it doesn't have that same feedback mechanism that the other currencies and think of it too, like if you're a government and you're issuing currency, like say you're Switzerland and you're in charge of the Swiss central bank. Switzerland has a history of having really strong currency. You know, if you go to Switzerland, you know that like a Big Mac costs the equivalent of like $11. It's crazy. And people look at that and they think, well, you know, why is the Swiss franc so expensive? Switzerland has the benefit, of course, of having, you know, a really high quality government. But what happens is if the Swiss franc becomes too valuable relative to other currencies, then suddenly it becomes more difficult for exporters within Switzerland to make money, because the goods and services that they're exporting to other countries becomes too expensive because you have to get the Swiss francs to buy them. And so it basically kills their export industry and they become a net importer. And this is what's happened to the U.S. is the U.S. dollar, being the global reserve currency, it becomes so valuable over time that the only way to save American exports is to occasionally devalue the dollar. And so governments actually are incentivized. They're incentivized to tear down the value of their currencies. And this is something that I think a lot of people don't understand, is that any government that issues a currency is under a huge amount of pressure to devalue that currency. And so that's the reason that people use, or central banks use, gold as a reserve and other assets as well. But ultimately, long term, central banks, I believe, will switch over to Bitcoin as their primary reserve asset. They're going to dump dollars, they're going to dump euros and these other assets, and they're going to move heavily into Bitcoin because of its properties. Its properties basically make it the ideal store of value.
But from the perspective of someone who's just an ordinary member of the public, I want to return to the question that I asked you. Why not just use PayPal?
So,
because I know everything you said is interesting,
yeah.
But I want to answer that question.
So I would recommend, in any case when you can use PayPal to make a donation or transfer money, or like Cash App or whatever, use it. You should. You shouldn't use Bitcoin for small transactions or small donations. You should use it for larger donations to people who have no access to the main banking system. So, for instance, nationalists, they're, of course, banned from certain systems. But even in that scenario, I would recommend, if you want to donate, use Monero, use Litecoin, use Ethereum, use some of these other currencies that have lower transaction fees. If you do want to donate Bitcoin, I'll tell you, the time to do that is on weekends, believe it or not. For some strange reason, weekends, the transaction fees on the Bitcoin network are lower on weekends. And in fact, there's a great website you can bookmark that I check regularly. It's called Bitcoiner.live, live, Bitcoiner.live. And it basically tells you up to the minute what the current transaction fee is for Bitcoin. And I'm not sure what it is right now, but I'm assuming, it's Monday, so it's probably kind of high. For most people, if you want to, I would recommend, if you're going to make a donation to a nationalist, use Monero, I think, is really good because it's anonymous. It has low transaction fees. And as far as investments go, long-term holding of money, I would recommend 90% plus of your portfolio should be Bitcoin. The reason I differ from Steve,
this is to do with you being a Bitcoin maximalist, where you're not terribly interested in investing in other cryptocurrencies. You think that people should concentrate on Bitcoin. So go for it. Why is that?
Yeah, well, because there's a few reasons, but the main one is that money generally is like a network effect. It's kind of, you can think of Bitcoin as kind of being like Facebook, right? The more people that use it, the more people are going to want it. So because of that network effect, it's really difficult for one of these altcoins to append or overturn Bitcoin. The closest any altcoin has ever come to doing that was Ethereum back in, like, I think 2016 or something. And in 2016, it got nearly 50%, not quite 50% of the total market for cryptocurrency, but then it fell rapidly after that. And another thing to think about, though, is that, like, in the event that an altcoin did usurp Bitcoin, that would actually be terrible for the entire industry, because at that point, that would suddenly signal to investors that, well, wait a second, you know, none of these coins is ever going to remain on top. It becomes sort of a in the air. It becomes a question. And at that point, investors can't sort of place their faith in Bitcoin. They have to continually research these up and coming little coins, because they have to continually wonder, well, okay, you know, what's the next Bitcoin? What's the next one that's going to replace it? So ideally, you would want to stick with Bitcoin. Plus, there's also liquidity issues. So, like, these other coins are super tiny. And so what that means is, like, Ethereum, I guess, is getting there. It's getting bigger. But the smaller a cryptocurrency is, the easier it is for traders to manipulate it. So traders can whack the value up and down rapidly. And also wealthy individuals and corporations are less likely to want to buy substantial amounts of a sort of flimsy little currency that's got a low market cap, because they're afraid that if they step into it, it'll cause the price to go haywire. So there's that reason too.
All right. So which other coins would you advise? Or obviously you're not a professional economist or whatever, I just use that as a disclaimer, but which other coins would you have time for? Because I know that you do say that people should concentrate on Bitcoin, but which other ones are interesting to you?
I like Litecoin because it's also fixed supply. I like Monero because it has the benefit of being anonymous. And, you know, occasionally you'll see people online saying stuff like, oh, Monero has been cracked and it's no longer anonymous. I don't buy that. I think that's just, you know, FUD that's put out by anti-Monero people. And I'm trying to think of if there's any others. You know, I would say Ethereum. I've never been interested in Ethereum, and I think the reason is because I look at Ethereum and it kind of strikes me as like it's almost like a Rube Goldberg machine. It's kind of unusually complex and strange. And, you know, I want to simplify this as much as possible. So unless you're investing like tens of thousands of dollars worth of capital, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense to spend your time studying all these different coins. And in my view, I think your time is better spent just stacking Bitcoin and focusing on other ways to make money, you know, like, because if you're spending hours every day studying altcoins, then to me, it's just not a wise use of your time. Yeah.
Okay. So to boil this down then, why would you say that people should get into cryptocurrency, especially Bitcoin?
Well, number one, because I think it's an immense opportunity for nationalists to make money. I mean, it really is that simple. I was able to make good money in it, but I think that we need to not, you know, as white nationalists, we should not focus on this sentiment that money is necessarily always a bad thing. I think we kind of fall into this because it's like, and that seeds ground to the enemy, because that basically gives them carte blanche to dominate markets.
Yeah.
And I see.
And they do, and they're happy to do that.
Yeah. And so I see an opportunity for our people to not necessarily dominate markets, but at least to secure a place in the middle and upper middle class. Because if you're a nationalist and you no longer need to fear losing your job, then that's a huge boon to your lifestyle. I mean, you're able to speak out more freely, and it just gives you enormous freedom.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
And that cannot really be overstated, because one of the things that paralyzes not just nationalism specifically, but dissident politics generally, is the risk, unless you're, you know, a far left Marxist, is the risk to your employment, to which in turn affects your social life, your social standing, your options in life, which of course that also impacts your romantic life, your ability to have a family. All of this is happily curtailed by our enemies, by our opponents. Whereas if you have something that is a source of income that cannot be tampered with, cannot be interfered with, cannot be denied you, then you're self-sufficient in a way and far more resilient and stronger.
Right. And the irony of this is what makes this kind of funny is that, you know, Bitcoin really started out among libertarians. And if you go to libertarian forums, I used to be a libertarian myself. If you go to their forums and you look at where it all started and you look at these libertarians, it's hilarious because they constantly talk about, you know, the need to prevent censorship and, you know, locking people out of the financial system and freedom and things like that. But they never, ever, ever mention white nationalists or the people that are actually being locked out. It's always about making sure that libertarians have freedom to speak. But libertarians, as far as I'm aware, you know, have never encountered this issue. So it's sort of like they facilitated the creation of this great thing, cryptocurrency, but they don't want to acknowledge that the main beneficiaries of it are people who are real political dissidents. who don't agree with them necessarily. I know we have some libertarians in our ranks, but it's
mostly recovering libertarians.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, there are some questions that will. Could people please post questions on entropy? Because it's very difficult for me to keep up with the live chat. So I've posted that link below so in the live chat, so you should be able to get to there easily. In the meantime, so are there any other reasons that you would say why people should get into this before we move on to the last part of this?
There's two main issues that I think people kind of have when they come up to Bitcoin. And the first is that they think it's too late to get into it. And again, that's because of where the decimal place is located. You know, you shouldn't look at the price of a full Bitcoin. Don't worry about that. Look at how many Satoshis you're getting. You're getting a lot. I think for $1, you can get like 4,500 Satoshis. So think of it that way. And then the other thing is that, in the same vein, I'll give you a good example, somewhat related, but in finance generally, just because a lot of people know about something and a lot of people talk about something doesn't mean that it's too late to invest in it. And a great example of this is Domino's Pizza. I don't know if you have Domino's Pizza in Europe or the UK.
Yes.
So when Domino's first went public, they first issued stock publicly. They had already been around for a long time before that, and everybody had already eaten Domino's Pizza, and everybody knew what Domino's Pizza was. So you would think that the day after the stock went public that it would, you know, instantly reach its fair value because everybody knows about it. Well, in fact, it went up 40-fold. So it's another great example is Apple. Right, like everybody knew back in the late 90s that computers were even the late 80s and early 90s, they knew that computers were the future. You could go up to anybody on the street, talk about computers, and they would say, yes, this is the future, right? But how many people owned a bunch of shares of Microsoft and Apple back then? And how many held on to it that long? Very, very few people. So just because a lot of people know about Bitcoin, how many people in your personal life do you know have a significant amount of Bitcoin? How many people have? I mean, most people who, I think probably, if I had to guess, I would say at least 80% of people who own Bitcoin probably only own maybe $100 worth. You know, so they're not buying substantial amounts of this stuff. So that's one thing. The other thing is that I see some hesitance among people in the dissident right, because they think that Bitcoin is a project of the CIA or the government or, you know, somebody nefarious that's trying to ruin people or track people or whatever. And I find that highly unlikely. I have an idea of who Satoshi Nakamoto is. I'm not going to say his name because I don't want to, you know, draw attention to him. But it probably was actually a group of guys. And like I said, they were computer scientists, libertarians. They're not, the way it's designed, the way the network functions, it's not designed with tracking in mind. In fact, it's really designed to be open to anybody. And it's as anonymous as you want it to be, but it takes a little bit of skill. It takes a little bit more skill than like Monero to be anonymous with Bitcoin. That's why I recommend Monero for beginners, because if you understand Bitcoin well and you've gotten accustomed to using it for a while, you can make it anonymous. It's possible to make it purely anonymous, but it requires a little bit of technical know-how, whereas Monero is a little bit more straightforward. So those are the two things. Bitcoin is not a nefarious project. In other words, I don't view it as a product of the CIA.
Okay. There was something you said there that I wanted to pick up on, which was, So as a way to, I mean, this is obviously for my own purposes, that's something that is of interest to me. It is a way that you can support dissident content creators, activists, etc., mm-hmm. who are frequently defunded, deplatformed from things like PayPal and Patreon. So I think that's another reason why some people will want to get into it simply out of necessity. I mean, if you want this movement to continue, then it's at some point it's going to be the only way that it can continue. Yeah. Otherwise, people are just going to have to either go on welfare or try to get normal jobs.
Yeah,
that is going to become a reality. But that's not the main reason why I'm doing these streams, just in case anyone accuses me of that. And I know that some people will. The main reason is I honestly think this is something that could help a lot of people. It could be of use to, it could actually reinvigorate a lot of people's lives who are, you know, neets, who are down in their luck, and so on. So I think that it's something for many reasons, it's something that I think that people should look into and get involved with. So the final thing I wanted to ask you then is, and this, please make this as boiled down as possible. How can people, what do you do to get Bitcoin, to get involved in this? What is the process?
The easiest way to get Bitcoin right now is to use an app on your phone called Cash App. And it's actually owned by Jack Dorsey, the guy who owns Twitter, or, you know, is the CEO of Twitter. So it's not, I wouldn't recommend buying huge amounts of Bitcoin through Cash App, but if you want to get started, it really is the easiest way to do it. You can create an account with them. It usually takes 1 or 2 days, and what they'll do is you will be asked to show a proof of ID and take a selfie with your phone. And basically that's not because they're suspicious personally of you, but because it's just a government requirement. So the government, for whatever reason in different countries, requires people to keep.
Yeah, I mean, this is to do with money. It's to do with finances. So of course they want. It's like opening a bank account. They're not going to let you just do it anonymously.
Right, right. Now, you can buy Bitcoin anonymously from individuals, but I still wouldn't recommend that because it's just, like I said, you can anonymize them later, and also you run into some scammers and, you know, less than savory people when you do that. It's better just to go ahead and get them from a reputable exchange. So Cash App is the first place I would go. And then if you want to start buying larger amounts of Bitcoin after you've seen it on Cash App and you've gotten a little bit there, I would recommend Gemini. I would say avoid Coinbase if you can, because for several reasons. First is that Coinbase is, as far as I know, is run by left-wingers. I think what happened back in 2013, late 2013, actually, right before that huge bubble, I was actually banned from Coinbase because I donated, I think, like $50 worth of Bitcoin to Stefan Molyneux. And I sent it directly from my Coinbase account to his Bitcoin account. So they somehow detected that and kicked me off of Coinbase. So anyway, that was my first scrape with Coinbase. But then later on, I started to notice that every time Bitcoin would have a steep crash or a sudden rise in the price, Coinbase would crash and nobody could get to it to either buy or sell. And so I think Coinbase is just, they're not a very professional, good company. They're not nearly as good as Gemini or, and in the UK, I think there's a company called CEX, which some other people have told me about. Most of these I haven't used personally. So I highly recommend if people want to learn about exchanges in their own countries, definitely ask people on the Crypto for Nationalists channel. Like, there's the Telegram channel that Steve talked about, and there's lots of guys on there from other countries outside of the U.S.
That's Crypto Nats, which is on Telegram, and that's linked from one of the previous streams, so people can find it easily.
Yeah, and so to get started, really, once you have an account with either Cash App or exchange like this, the first step is going to be you transfer fiat currency to the exchange. So that's step one. Then once the currency appears in the exchange, it's just sitting there. It's not actually, it doesn't actually get deployed, and you don't buy the Bitcoins until another step. So you can put as much fiat into the account as you want to, and you can wait to buy it whenever you feel like it. So that's the good thing. The second thing is that once you click buy and you actually you can set up a recurring buy. It's possible to buy on a schedule in most of these apps. So I highly recommend that, because if you can say, like, I'll buy, you know, $100 or $200 worth every last Thursday of every month, right? That way you're price agnostic. You're not so scared about the price anymore because it becomes sort of a, just a regularly scheduled thing, and you're not worried about price action. And that's another thing I really want to emphasize to people is please don't try trading, because while it is possible to trade successfully, most people can't do that because it's professional traders will take amateurs to the cleaners. And the way they do it is that they will dump cryptocurrency when there's good news, and they'll pump it up high when there's bad news. So the news, like what you're reading in the news on a day-to-day basis about certain coins or whatever, that has no bearing whatsoever on what the price is doing. So please don't try to trade, because you'll end up really hurting yourself, in my view anyway. I never traded. I just accumulated.
Again, to boil this down, so you would get an account with an exchange. You'd get it verified, which the requirements can vary from one country to another. Then you put some money in from your bank account. And then with that money, you buy some crypto of whichever currency you want.
Right.
And then you let it accumulate. And it might not accumulate. It might, what's the word? What's the opposite of accumulate? I don't know what the word is.
Crash or devalue, I guess. Yeah, it might go down.
Yeah, there is chance involved in this. There is risk involved in this. But again, you should just research this, make the decisions that you want to make, informed. And then at a certain point, you can, using that same exchange, you then can sell the crypto for fiat money and then transfer that to your bank account. That's
right,
how.
You can sell at any point 24/7. So it's not, you don't have to worry about being locked into a certain currency. Like I said, don't focus too much on the price. Just, I would recommend focusing on just accumulating Bitcoin. And, like I said, because transaction fees tend to be kind of high on the weekdays, wait until the weekends to move the crypto, to move the Bitcoin off of the exchange onto your private wallet. And once you get to a certain amount of Bitcoin, like say $1,000 or $2,000 worth, somewhere in there, it makes sense to actually purchase a hardware wallet and to store your own Bitcoins. And in that case, I would highly recommend getting a Trezor. It's called it's spelled Trezor. And you can find it on Amazon. And essentially, it's just a small device that is unhackable. It allows you to store your private keys without worrying about, it doesn't matter how virus-ridden your computer is, it's not possible for a hacker to obtain your coins from that. So, but generally, just focus on accumulating over time. Don't worry too much about the short-term price action, because right now we're kind of in a euphoric period. I anticipate it could have a little correction from here. But, you shouldn't wait to buy it. In other words, don't wait for a correction, because I see a lot of people doing this. In the last few months before this huge rise, there were a bunch of people coming to me on Twitter asking me, you know, should I wait for it to fall before I buy? And I said, no, go ahead and get it now. And the reason is because, your own personal feelings about the price has no bearing on what it's actually going to do. So it's best just to sort of average your way into it over time.
All right. Okay, there are several questions here. If people could post questions on Entropy, that's great. The links are there. So I'm not sure which one to start with. Okay, this is probably going to be considered a meme question, but it is a serious one. Let's say shit hits the fan and they completely shut down the internet. How is Bitcoin better than tangible currency alternatives?
Okay, so in that scenario, your Bitcoins would still exist, because the blockchain itself is going to still be recorded on hard drives scattered all across the world. So they're still going to be there. The thing is you're not going to have access to them. So as long as the electricity and the internet is down, they're essentially frozen in time. And there's no way for... Now, this is obviously a bad thing, but it's also a good thing in a way because it means that people can't sell them, right? So essentially the price freezes where it was when the system shut down. In a total breakdown of society scenario, the things you want are going to be physical cash and probably, ammunition and like just sort of valuable trinkets, valuable goods.
Stereotypical post-apocalyptic stuff.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but see, this sort of like, this is like the scenario that's posed a lot. And it's like, I mean, I respect it because I do think that it's definitely possible. You know, it could happen. But you have to keep in mind, like, if this does happen, it's Bitcoin is not the only thing that's going to go down. You know, there's a lot of things that are going to be different. So,
yeah, of course, it's a sort of it's an extreme scenario. Okay, someone says, what if you lose the physical Trezor wallet, though?
Okay, so what a Trezor does, like, so Bitcoins themselves are not discrete computer files, right? All they are is they're just numbers on a giant database. So what a Trezor does is the Trezor is storing your private keys. It's not storing the Bitcoins themselves. So if somebody comes and steals your Trezor, they'll still have to break into it somehow. They have to get the PIN number. They also have to figure out if you put a passphrase on it, which you can do. They'll have to figure out the passphrase. Of course, they could do this by pointing a gun at you. So it's best just to try to hide it and not tell anybody you own Bitcoin. If you have a lot of Bitcoin, it's probably a good idea not to tell people you have it. But the other thing is even if somebody gets your Trezor or destroys it, you can still make a backup copy of the private keys. And what's really cool about this is that some computer scientists figured out a way to take the private key, which is this ridiculously long string of random numbers and letters, and convert that into a list of 12 English words. So it's like it's a seed, and they call it a seed. But what it is it's just a list of 12 random words. And as long as you have that list of 12 random words, you can go out and buy another Trezor or just type them in on your computer wallet and it will recreate the wallet as it was. And basically what it does is it gives the new wallet your private keys, and the Bitcoins themselves are still there because they're stored on the blockchain.
Okay. Someone else said, and I think this is a facetious remark, but I'll read it out anyway. He said, how will you pay the grocer for your milk if the internet goes down, genius?
Okay, so let's see here. Again, in this scenario, you're going to want cash. I mean, I can't, you know, this is the thing. I would never tell anybody to put 100% of their assets into Bitcoin, right?
I feel like saying, well, how are you going to fly to Mars with a car?
Well, yeah, I mean, and, you know, this is like, I'll tell you, this is actually classified as a Nirvana fallacy, right? And, you know, I remember back in like 2013, there was huge amount of this BS from people who hated Bitcoin, and they would, you know, they would say, what's going to happen when Bitcoin can't do X or can't do Y? Bitcoin, I readily admit, like I openly admit, Bitcoin is a clunky contraption. It's like a really, it's really imperfect. It has lots of inconvenient aspects to it, right? But when you actually, if you actually understand the network and why it is built the way it is, you see that it's designed to be durable and resistant to attacks. And in order to be resistant to attacks from, you know, governments and corporations and things like that, and hackers and stuff, it's got to be clunky. You know, there's going to be aspects of it that are going to be inefficient. Now, so I totally admit that, right? Bitcoin isn't perfect. But where Bitcoin shines and what makes Bitcoin really special is, like I said, that extreme unparalleled scarcity. And that scarcity is why the value, or why we should expect the value to continue to rise, because the exact same mechanism that took it from $10 to $100 and then $100 to $1,000 and $1,000 to $10,000 is going to take it from $10,000 to $100,000. There's nothing fundamentally different about these increments, right? It's going to keep on rising simply because it's like because of the extreme scarcity aspect of it. People can, you know, anybody can make cheap transactions occur. It's simple to do that. I remember people were saying that Bitcoin was going to die when the transaction fees went above like 50 cents or something. And it did. It didn't die, but the price crashed. And as the price, and this was back, I think, when it was like $13 or $14 per coin, the transaction fees got up. And people started to worry that, okay, this is no longer competitive with PayPal. A lot of people started to sell. And of course, it was like somebody screaming fire in a theater, right? Everybody headed for the exits at once. And so the blockchain got even more congested, and that drove transaction fees even higher. But then it caught a bottom, and then it kind of resumed climbing. And the reason, again, is just because people prefer to use it as a store rather than a transactional medium.
Okay. I'll ask another question. I've opened an atomicwallet.io, an account. It says I can buy Bitcoin direct to the wallet. Is there any reason I shouldn't do that and should instead use an exchange like crypto.com and then transfer it to Atomic Wallet?
I have never used Atomic Wallet, so I'm not sure. I don't know if it's a reputable place. Like I said, some people in that chat on Telegram would know better than I do. I recommend, if you're wanting to get into crypto and Bitcoin, I can tell people some good accounts to follow on Twitter. One is Dan Held, D-A-N-H-E-L-D. He's a really good guy on Twitter. And another one is Pierre Rocard. Try to remember how to spell his name.
I'll add these links to the description afterwards.
Yeah. Pierre Rocard. Yeah, I'll give you the link, and people can find it in the description. But if you study what these people are posting, and you sort of get into that milieu on Twitter, you'll see advice, and you'll see people discussing these different things. But yeah, Atomic Wallet is not something I'm familiar with. I wish I could tell you the answer to that.
All right. And then another question. Did you address the Nano Ledger leaks that happened today? Can you explain why it's so bad, and if something like this is more likely to happen in the future, or is it a one-off?
Yeah, that's the reason I didn't recommend buying a Ledger. I think because the hardware wallet business is not very competitive, it's kind of a new thing. There's not much incentive for these companies to be well-behaved. But Trezor is one company that I'm really impressed with, because every aspect of their hardware wallet is totally open source, including the chips that they use to make it. So I respect the guys behind Trezor a lot. The Ledger company, they had a leak where, I don't know if it was somebody on the inside or somebody leaked a bunch of users who had purchased one of these wallets. And so now they're getting spam from shady individuals who are basically threatening them to give them their cryptocurrency. But I mean, you know, if you receive a email like that, just ignore it, because they don't really have anything that they can, unless they actually come to your house, you know, in which case you should have a gun, but whatever.
Okay. If you're in America, obviously. It's Anna. Here's a good question. It's possible to see Bitcoin transactions. The government will likely try to tax those transactions. That ties us back to central banking and the government. Doesn't that put us right back at square one? The fact that the government can see Bitcoin transactions and tax them.
Right. Yeah. So, yes, they could tax them. And in fact, they already kind of do. They already, like in the U.S. at least, they have we have capital gains tax, and I think in other countries too, they'll tax gains. I think, like I said, I think that that won't impact Bitcoin's rise as a store of value. I think that the government will always be able to tax things. And this is something like, you know, Bitcoin, when anarcho-capitalists were the main people starting in Bitcoin, a lot of them were saying that Bitcoin would end up killing the government. And that's absolutely nonsensical. Like, I mean, you still need a place to live, and the government will just simply turn to taxing homes and, you know, cars and property like that. If they can't tax the money, they'll move there. But over time, what will happen, I think, is that the Bitcoins that the government is aware of and the government knows who owns them, those coins will become fewer and fewer over time as they sort of either get mixed or get lost in the shadows. You'll have a growing black market of unknown Bitcoin addresses. And people will pay cash, and they'll trade goods for those anonymous Bitcoins, so to speak. So there's always going to be a black market for Bitcoin, unless they shut down the whole network somehow, which is extremely difficult to do. I think we'll see that black market grow. But as a store of value, Bitcoin is just really has no comparison.
All right. And hold on a second. Respectfully, I disagree with Carl. I've made much better returns with altcoins than with Bitcoin. At the peak of this cycle, Bitcoin expected 20 times growth. Some altcoins are already at 200 times growth. Medium-term holds, not trading.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, I wouldn't deny that it's possible to make a lot of money in altcoins. But I advise against it because I think that the risk reward ratio isn't good. It's sort of like running out in the traffic to get a $1 bill. In my view, it's better just to stick with the tried and true. And it's the one that large companies like MicroStrategy and, potentially Tesla soon are going to be investing in. So you look at like Paul Tudor Jones, who is a really well-respected hedge fund manager. He only is interested in investing in Bitcoin. You know, Bill Miller, Stanley Drunken Miller. I mean, there's a bunch of Wall Street guys who were only talking about Bitcoin and only interested in investing in that. And like I said, the reason is because they view Bitcoin correctly, I think, as the primary beneficiary of a flood of trillions of dollars of capital. Because what I think is going to happen in the next few years is that you're going to see all of these trillions of dollars and pounds and euros that are currently being tied up in negative yielding bonds. Because, you know, right now central banks have huge amounts of bonds that are yielding negative. That's insane to think about. Like, people are actually paying money to lose money. It's idiotic, right? But you might wonder, well, why are they doing that? Why do people buy a negative yielding bond? And the reason is because a lot of this money is tied up in pension funds. And those pension funds are required to buy assets that are quote unquote low risk. And bonds are the lowest risk, right? So what's going to happen is that, or what I anticipate will happen, is that a lot of that money will move out of bonds and into Bitcoin over the next few years. And it's because money is looking to park itself in a place where it's going to get better yield. It's going to get better returns. So that's sort of and also there's the simple fact that, like, I mean, you don't have to know anything about Bitcoin to understand this. Like, Bitcoin is not available through traditional brokerage accounts yet. So if you're a rich guy, or if you're just, you know, whoever, and you call up your broker on the phone and you say, buy me $1 million worth of Bitcoin today, he'll say, I'm sorry, I can't do that. There's no way for the broker to do that. But you can buy it yourself off of an exchange. So what's going to happen is soon the SEC and these other regulatory agencies are going to allow a Bitcoin ETF, an exchange-traded fund, to go public on stock exchanges. And when Bitcoin ETFs become publicly available to traditional brokerage firms, suddenly you're going to have a huge flood of boomer money, basically, who they're going to be calling up the broker saying, I want X amount of Bitcoin, and the broker will be able to fill the order. And so this is like, it's a huge opportunity because you have access, you're able to buy something before the big old fashioned brokerage firms can get into it. So this gives you kind of a leg up on those guys.
Yeah, it's a very important point. We've got less than 10 minutes left because I have to appear on Red Ice in 10 minutes.
I'm glad you remembered that. I had written it down, but I...
Okay, so we'll just have to rattle through the remaining questions. So the main value to me of any cryptocurrency is that it's a shield from prying government eyes and hands, aka tax collectors. Is it possible to invest in Bitcoin without having the government being informed?
Yes. So I will preface this by saying I'm not advocating you break the law, yes, right? Just but anyway, the way you would do it is you would have cash and you would find somebody who would be willing to buy it for you. You would not give that person your information. So you would remain anonymous to them. You would meet them in a public place. You would give them your Bitcoin address. They would transfer the Bitcoins to your address and you would confirm on your phone that they actually sent to that address. Once the transaction is confirmed, you would hand them the cash.
That sounds like something from Blade Runner.
Yeah. And of course, you know, there's danger in this because, like, anytime you go to meet somebody in public, like a stranger, and you've got a big wad of cash with you, you're kind of setting yourself up for trouble. So I wouldn't advise it, but it's possible to do. And once you have those Bitcoins, they are officially anonymous.
All right. And then another question, would you agree that, what about the fees? Won't they go up as the price rises?
Yes. So the fees will go up. They'll probably hit, if I had to guess, I think the most I ever paid for a fee was like, I think it was like $10 or $15 for a single transaction. And that was back during the December of 2017 bubble. But I bet we'll probably see fees go up to $50 to $80 for a single transaction in probably the next 8 or 9 months during this coming bubble. It's not going to be consistent. Like, what'll happen is eventually the network clears out the high priority transactions and you're left with the lower fee transactions. And so fees come back down. But eventually even weekend fees will be like $4 or $5 per transaction. And that's actually a good thing. You want high transaction fees when it comes to Bitcoin, because those fees supplement the miners. And this gets into sort of technical details, and I probably shouldn't get into it here, so I won't. But right, suffice it to say, high transaction fees is not necessarily a bad thing for Bitcoin. And another reason it's not bad is because in the future, and actually in the present, but to a greater degree in the future, more and more Bitcoin transactions will occur off the blockchain. They'll occur on other networks, secondary networks. So,
all right. And then thoughts on, if you've already talked about Ethereum, but someone's asking, well, thoughts on Ether, and I think he means Ethereum. So any thoughts on Ethereum, just to wrap that up?
I think you can make money in it. I think that I personally don't like it, but I'm open-minded about it, you know, because I don't want to be totally closed-minded about things. I would recommend... There are several guys on YouTube that I follow that occasionally talk about Ethereum. And so I'll link a couple of those to you and you can share them. But if you're interested in Ethereum, it's probably one of the it's like the most popular currency besides Bitcoin cryptocurrency. So it's probably not too dangerous. But at the same time, like I said, in my view, keep it to 10% or less of your total portfolio.
Okay. And then a slightly not relevant question to, well, not relevant to Bitcoin. So does a strong dollar policy actually prevent America from being an autarky?
Okay. There's something called the Triffin dilemma. It's a T-R-I-F-F-E-N dilemma. And basically, I think that's what he's referring to. Basically what it is, like I said, anytime a country has a very strong strong currency, it becomes it becomes untenable because for the reason that it destroys the export industry. So nations need exports. I take that back. I mean, I guess they need to be economically competitive. If they have to have exports if they want to be economically competitive. But you want a weaker currency to help your export industry. The alternative to that which is preferable in my view, is to have a government that institutes high tariffs. I think tariffs are probably one of the least offensive and best taxes that a government can institute. And, you know, libertarians will say, tariffs are terrible because they, raise the price of imported goods. But you should think of it kind of like lifting weights, right? Like if you have high tariffs, it's like lifting heavy weights. It basically forces the people within the country to figure out ways to develop and build up their own industry so that they don't have to import so much, right? If you're entirely reliant on imports, then you're giving yourself a huge disadvantage. And that's what's happening in the US right now. So that's sort of the beauty of Bitcoin. And that might also actually be a reason that central banks might want to see Bitcoin succeed, strangely enough, because in a weird way, a successful Bitcoin, it means that central banks no longer have to worry about the Triffin dilemma.
Right. All right. Well, seems like an interesting way to end it, but perhaps we'll do a similar stream again in the future. Any final thoughts on just any remarks about where people can find you and why they should get into Bitcoin and so on?
Yeah. You can find me on Twitter, obviously. I'm on Twitter as Carl Thorburn. That's with a K. Let's see here. You know, I've written down some things that I probably should mention. I think that's mostly it. I think, the technical aspects of how to get Bitcoin, really the best way to get into it is to start talking to people who actually use it. I'm talking about like in chat rooms and things like that, and go to forums. You'll learn a lot, and you'll learn more than you could learn from me, because my experience is like I avoid complexity. I try to simplify my experience of Bitcoin, but other people, they test out a lot of different wallets. They test, they try out a lot of different exchanges and things like that. So definitely talk to those guys, because like on Crypto for Nationalists chat and things like that, they're going to be more helpful as far as that goes.
All right. Okay, well, thank you very much, Carl Thorburn, for hopefully introducing a lot of people to this this whole world of cryptocurrency. In the meantime, I'll head off because I've got to get onto Red Ice. So, okay, I'll be back in an hour on DLive with Jared Taylor.
Okay, so thanks so much.
All right. Thank you, Carl, and I'll see you all in a wee while, either in an hour or right now on Red Ice. See you later.